Welcome to the Burt Cohen Show. History goes on and on and on, and sometimes America does the right thing. Every now and then we stumble into a policy and stick with it. There's that old song, Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, and the big fool says to push on. Well, that was about Lyndon Johnson, but here we are in Afghanistan right now, and opium is a big part of the problem in Afghanistan. It's not something that many people understand how much it factors into Afghani politics. But our guest today, Alfred McCoy, knows quite a bit about it. And it's pretty interesting, pretty sobering, actually, looking at it. And Professor McCoy, thanks for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show today.
Thank you very much, Burt. Happy to be there.
And for reference, Alfred McCoy is professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a beautiful campus, I must say. He's the author of The Politics of Heroin, CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade. His most recent book is Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. And that's from the University of Wisconsin Press, and it's pretty recent. And you say that Afghanistan was slowly transformed from a diverse agricultural ecosystem with herding, orchards, and over 60 food crops into the world's first economy dependent on production of a single illicit drug. Since the U.S. invasion back in the fall of 2001, what has happened with regard to that single illicit drug, opium?
Sure, the results have been rather dramatic. In their last months in power, the Taliban government, that fundamentalist Islamic government that ruled Afghanistan from 1996 to 2001, decided to win international recognition. They were badly isolated, by banning the poppy crop and using the ruthlessness for which the Taliban is so justly famous. They actually imposed a very effective poppy ban. They slashed the country's production from around 4,000 tons all the way down to 185 tons, a 94% reduction. And then when we invaded in 2001, within the first year, poppy production in Afghanistan soared from 185 tons to 3,000 tons, and it kept climbing steadily to an amazing 8,200 tons in the year 2007, just 3 years ago. At that time, the UN reported that Afghanistan was providing over 90% of the world's heroin, and opium accounted for 53% of Afghanistan's entire economy. This is unprecedented. We've never been in a situation in human history where you've had a modern state economically dependent upon the production of a single illicit commodity. Let's conjure Colombia back in the 1980s, where from television and movies, everybody should be aware that this was the era of the famous cartels. Pablo Escobar had hundreds of Cicatero assassins. There was an attack on the Ministry of Justice building. Down in the south, the FARC, the Revolutionary Forces, captured much of the country, produced illegal cocaine. The right-wing death squads or militias in the north controlled much of the traffic. The country was plunged into violence. It penetrated presidential politics. Well, at that time, at the peak of the cocaine boom in Colombia, it accounted for just 3%. That's 1-3% of the country's economy, its gross domestic product. Well, in 2007, It was 53% in Afghanistan. That's unprecedented. And it appears to have three consequences. First, the aim of all counterinsurgency is to establish the authority of the government, its control over the country and
right.
its people.
Right.
And in a poor society with weak social services, this means above all controlling or assisting agriculture. Well, when the prime agricultural commodity is illegal, it's by definition beyond government control, so the government can't do that. Second, when you have over 50% of your economy, the consequence of an illegal commodity, the corruption eviscerates the government. It penetrates all levels of government, all the way from village headmen to provincial governors, who are basically just warlords and drug lords, all the way up to the president's brother and right-hand man, who is not only a CIA asset, but he's also reputed to be a principal in the country's drug trade. The third consequence is that since 2006, the Taliban has come back from the dead,
yeah.
and it's spread over the country to the point where we now have 120,000 allied forces in country, and we can't control the Taliban. So two things have happened. One, opium has boomed, and two, the Taliban has spread. And most accounts indicate that about $400 or $500 million from the opium traffic goes to the Taliban. And just as importantly, of course, the Taliban, because they protect and control much of that traffic, particularly at the local level among the farmers, they get that kind of political loyalty and political control that comes from controlling the country's agricultural economy. And so, in effect, as one of my sources in the U.S. Embassy put it, we can't win this war without tackling drug production in Helmand Province. And the U.S. National Security Advisor on the press plane flying to Kabul last week during President Obama's flying visit told reporters more or less the same thing, that, you know, that he said in his briefing, he was quoted as saying that the drug money finances the Taliban. It's the engine that drives their machine, and we have to tackle this problem.
And we are talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Professor Alfred McCoy, who knows whereof he speaks. He's the author of Politics of Heroin, CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade, and we're talking about Afghanistan. And one of the things, about, as you mentioned, about a guerrilla war is the question of legitimacy. For a government to have real power, it has to be recognized as the legitimate, real government by most of the population. And the Karzai government seems, I wonder, does the Taliban have the legitimacy of the people, or does neither one have the legitimacy, and it's just absolute chaos, and it's just, in the drug business?
That's a very good question. First of all, we know, obviously, far more about the Karzai government, our allies in this struggle, all right, than we do about the Taliban. And people will talk more readily about their feelings about the government than they will about the Taliban, because obviously if you're a peasant farmer in rural Afghanistan, you're going to have to be very cautious
sure.
about your attitude towards the insurgents, particularly if you're speaking with anybody who might be reporting in any way to the United States Embassy or to the government in Kabul. So let's look at our side of the equation. Okay, our ultimate plan is we're coming in with a surge to stabilize the situation and then turn over security to the Afghan police and the Afghan army, which we're building up at great expense. By all accounts, the only 10% of the Afghan police are literate.
Ooh.
So we've got 90% of the cops can't read or write. Second, there's a very high level of drug addiction. They're very corrupt. They're extraordinarily abusive. Most of the peasants fear the police far more than they do the Taliban, and with probably good reason.
Mm.
And because of the drug traffic, of course, they're completely corrupted, just like most of the government. So not only do they lack legitimacy, but in fact, it's quite the opposite. They're rather despised. They're incompetent. And totally corrupt. The army isn't much better, although it's not as much of a constant presence in the countryside as the police are. And then the provincial governments, know, let's look at, let's take the next locus of a major U.S. operation. We're supposedly going into Kandahar province, the old heartland of the Taliban, its kind of moral center, if you will. Mm. Well, our two right-hand men in that province, one is President Karzai's brother,
right.
who's supposedly involved heavily in the drug traffic, a very corrupt warlord, and then it's Gulagda Shuzai, who was a former drug trafficker and a former warlord of that before the Taliban took power in 1996. So, in effect, we have as the two most powerful figures in a key province in south-central Afghanistan, basically one retired drug lord, one active drug lord, both very corrupt, and neither of whom has an electoral mandate. That's another problem with the government, that at the provincial and local levels, these officials are not elected. They're appointed by Kabul.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they don't have much, they don't have a mandate, and they're very corrupt.
Mm. I wonder what the average person can do, you know, because, you know, there's certainly fear and respect are two very significant factors in any kind of legitimacy. It seems like there's fear coming down from both sides, from the Taliban as well as the corrupt government.
Yeah, it's the problem really dates, I mean, there's two causes. One is the longer-term problem. You know, through basically now 30 years and three wars, the CIA-covered operation against the Soviets in the 1980s,
right.
The Civil War of the 1990s, which was partially funded by the CIA, they put $900 million of seed money into it, into backing the Mujahideen for taking power, which didn't work. And then, of course, our operations there over the last 9 years since 2001. Through each of these operations, what's happened is Afghanistan has been transformed, as you said, from this very diverse agricultural economy with a very delicate ecological balance. And that balance was smashed. And the result has been the rise of opium. Even at the time of the start of this operation back in 1979, Afghanistan had 20 million people surviving in a harsh climate in a very arid terrain through a delicate ecological balance of, first of all, a very elaborate snow melt irrigation systems that captured the snow runoff and channeled it to the fields and in the productive land. Second, herds, very large herds of sheep and goats that the Afghani farmers and herders practice a very elaborate movement of these herds from winter pasture in the lowlands to summer pasture up in hills, taking the herds hundreds of miles to get the green, fresh grass. And then, above all, orchards that root deep, things like mulberries, pistachio nuts, root deep, survive droughts, and are kind of a fallback for the country's periodic droughts. Well, in the first 20 years of this war, the Soviet, with their enormous firepower, blasted the countryside. The Taliban, you know, devastated all the areas where they occupied and faced any kind of resistance. So the herds were destroyed. The fields weren't planted, were abandoned, sown with landmines instead of seeds. The snowmelt irrigation was damaged badly and smashed, and the orchards were basically destroyed, blasted by Soviet firepower, cut down by the Taliban. And so we face this real problem of a very costly reconstruction of a delicate ecological balance that has to be rebuilt over time. The other more immediate cause is when we went in late 2001, right after 9/11, the CIA was the lead agency in that operation, and they literally loaded about $70 million in $100 bills on pallets, and they helicoptered it in and handed it out to the warlords, who then, as the Taliban collapsed, swept across the countryside and filled the political vacuum. Well, these warlords were well-established drug lords, and they presided over the replanting of the poppy and the rebuilding of those illicit market linkages that made Afghanistan today the source of 90% of the world's opium and heroin. So we've got, you know, if you will, a long-term ecological trajectory and a medium-term political problem that have come together. And we've a result, literally, waist-deep in poppy plants in Afghanistan and no easy way out.
So that there have been efforts to certainly eradicate the crop and somehow replace the crop, but can that just happen? I mean, it seems to make sense to help them get diversified again, just wipe out.
Well, we've tried some short-term solutions. One of the things the Bush administration did was it basically didn't want to get involved in the drug problem, and so it outsourced drug eradication to the British and police development to the Germans. So when the British were running it, they tried, and we tried as well, the idea of quick payments to farmers, go into districts, prime opium districts, and pay them either to destroy their crop or to not plant. And that turned out, it incentivized farmers to double up next year. So it actually produced more opium in the next crop cycle. The other thing is, in 2005, we hired one of these defense contractors, a company named DynCorp. And DynCorp got a $150 million contract in certain selected areas to attempt actual physical or manual drug eradication, go in and tear up the poppy plants. Right. This produced violence, number of killings. Farmers were supposed to reimburse. Warlords pocketed the money. Farmers were angry. It didn't work at all. So, in effect, every year we come up with another short-term solution to the problem, which doesn't work and wastes another year. And we've been doing this for 9 years, heading into 10 years. And so our search for short-term solution condemns us to being there for 10 years and no exit in the future. My argument, my suggestion would be, is that there is a model that worked. Back in the 1980s, the then UN Drug Control Program went into Thailand, which was part of the Golden Triangle. And at that point in the 1980s, the Golden Triangle was producing about 70% of the world's heroin supply. So the UN said, look, our aim is to get rid of drugs, but we're going to do this by not focusing on drugs. We're going to do this through comprehensive rural development, integrated rural development, everything it takes to build the inputs for legal agriculture so farmers can drop their participation in illicit drugs, which they only do, they only get a very tiny percentage of the actual money that's made from illicit drugs. So it's actually it's not that difficult. And so over a period of 10 years, the UN put in roads. They developed new seeds. They built markets. They did agricultural extensions with farmers. They did irrigation, putting in terraces in hill areas where the poppies grow. At the end of 10 years, Thailand moved by degrees, slowly but surely, away from opium production and effectively eliminated illicit opium production within a decade. The same program with adaptations could work in Afghanistan. We just haven't tried it because we keep looking for the quick fix, the short-term solution that's going to get our troops out of there fast.
And it's probably not going to happen again. Bert Cohen here. We're talking with Professor Alfred McCoy about opium, how big a problem opium is in the war in Afghanistan. And amazingly enough, some people get cynical about politics and what's going on here. Big surprise, of course. Some have suggested that, well, we wouldn't be in Iraq if not for the oil there. And people have wondered, would we be in Afghanistan if not for the opium? Your reaction to that?
Yeah, I get, I mean, although I'm a liberal, I get attacked from the left all the time on this point by taking a too moderate position. My view is, look, if you're looking that idea that we're there for the drugs would have the argument that the CIA is somehow funding itself or from the illicit drug traffic, and this is somehow funding our entire covert war in Afghanistan, or the CIA is manipulating the market in some way. Although the agency does have alliances with drug traffickers, among them the president's brother, President Karzai's brother, and there are times in which CIA policy has impacted very directly on the drug situation, okay? I mean, the whole idea to use the CIA to go in there and fight the Mujahideen and let the Mujahideen profit from the drugs at the same time that we were putting in $3 billion of covert arms into Afghanistan, yes, that was a contributing factor. The CIA's decision to ally with the warlords-come-drug lords back in October 2001 to overthrow the Taliban, yes, that was an important factor. But where we are now, 9 years after that operation, The CIA has really lost, or any agency has lost, its capacity to impact directly on the global illicit drug trade, which is now finds one of its epicenters in Afghanistan. Let me explain. In 1997, the UN did a very controversial study, the first major study the UN did, of the world drug traffic, and they concluded the world traffic in illicit drugs, essentially at that point, cocaine, opium, and marijuana. Methamphetamines weren't that big yet. And they concluded this traffic constituted 8% of world trade. The transnational syndicates involved in drugs had 3,500,000 members, and that there were about the total amount of money in the illicit traffic was about $500 billion. Well, when you're talking of 8% of world trade, that's bigger than automobiles, steel. It's bigger than textiles. And after all, textiles is one of four basic human fundamentals for survival. So the illicit drug traffic is bigger than the global trade in textiles. In other words, it's a complex global commodity which operates by a market logic that, you know, that, and because it's illicit, it's badly studied and poorly understood. And most commodities, most markets operate beyond the control of human agency. Sure, government action, covert or overt, can impact upon the market and produce, for the most cases, unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm.
But it's beyond human control.
Mm. Well, I wonder what can be done now. You have pointed out that the cost of the president's new surge is about $30 billion a year, and you've said that, quote, the idea that our expanded military presence might soon succeed in driving back that force, meaning the Taliban, and handing over pacification to the illiterate, drug-addicted Afghan police and army remains, for the time being, a fantasy, end of quote. Could you suggest a new American policy that has a chance of success for possibly, you know, getting Afghanistan off of the necessity of growing opium, and that can bring our people home and bring actual peace to the area? Or is it just too late for that? And maybe Pakistan factors into this as well.
Well, I mean, there is the complicating factor of Pakistan. But if we're, you know, and what we're doing inside Pakistan is done covertly. We only know a tiny fragment of what's really going on there. But let's just focus on Afghanistan.
Sure.
And deal with, you know, much of the countryside that we're trying to pacify to build linkages with legitimate government. Basically what goes on is this. Every spring the snows melt, the poppy breaks through the soil, and every year a new crop of Taliban fighters, generally poor peasants recruited from the villages, take to the field to fight U.S. forces. And a lot of them die, and some of us die. And the next year, it happens again, and we go on and on. So clearly, you know, redeveloping the Afghan rural economy in a serious and comprehensive way will have two benefits. First of all, it will create employment, an alternative to taking the Taliban's $300 to $500 a month to pick up a gun and go fight the Americans. And that's what's paid. We recently increased payment to the Afghan National Police because we realized we're paying them less than the Taliban was paying their guerrilla fighters.
Mm-hmm.
So the money is critical in this. The second thing is by rebuilding the infrastructure for agriculture to allow the reconstruction of something akin to that fragile ecological balance that was there 30 years ago. Rebuilding that will allow farmers to produce legitimate market crops that can compete with the opium so that they can, you know, get out of the opium production and get into legitimate crops, which actually for most farmers is quite appealing.
I would
because
think.
They don't have to pay off, they don't have to deal with the theft of the commodity. And at the rural level in Afghanistan, this is very possible because right now, the farmer earns only three times as much from opium as he or she does from a legitimate crop like wheat. And so it's not impossible to slowly build up the inputs so legitimate crops can compete and effectively displace opium from the countryside. Once we do that, two things will happen. One, people will be employed. Employment will be higher. Second, the Taliban won't have the cash to pay those fighters. And so the relationship between drugs and the expansion of the Taliban, which apparently has operated for about the last 5 years, will be broken. And it's not an instant solution. It's not an easy solution. But I think by default at this point, after 10 years in Afghanistan and the situation getting worse, it's probably the only choice we have.
Well, do you think Obama is getting this? And certainly it's tougher to sell. I think, you know, the American population, which has to vote in elected officials, tends to prefer quick, easy solutions that they can see. You're talking about probably an expensive, long-term solution, and it's got to be sold to the people. Do you think Obama gets this, or is he still relying on the same old, you know, just go in and overpower them militarily, and that's how we win?
From all of our press accounts, and that's what I'm relying on, of the debates inside the Oval Office, that long-projected debate about Afghanistan policy where, you know, Vice President Biden took one position, other cabinet office took another position, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton took one, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates took another. The only thing that appeared to have been on the table was either an overt expansion of our forces on the ground, with people advocating between 10 and 40,000 troops for the surge. Obama, as we all know, picked the 30,000 figure. Mm-hmm. The alternative put forward was an emphasis on covert warfare, special operations forces, and an expansion of the drones, the Predator drones, to assassinate top Taliban figures and top figures inside Pakistan in Al-Qaeda. To the best of my knowledge, this medium-term development strategy was not on the table. In other words, it was military or CIA, and those were the full parameters of our choices. And I think that's a tragedy.
Yeah.
Because Obama is certainly a far more intelligent man than I am, frankly, and he's a very clever man. And had that option been presented to him, and somebody could make a convincing case, and I think I've made at least a case worth listening to, he might have decided otherwise. And so right now we're locked into this military come covert solution for a situation that's being driven by an economic and development problem. And mind you, you know, our General McChrystal is not unaware of this, okay? Our U.S. ambassador, Ambassador Eikenberry in Kabul, another military guy, neither of them are aware of this. I mean, U.S. forces, the U.S. mission in Afghanistan is, in fact, trying to understand something of the drug situation. Yeah. That's why they have turned away from the idea of simple eradication. They have a sophisticated enough understanding. They realize if they do that, that will have a devastating impact on the countryside. You can't simply go and destroy between 30 and 50% of a nation's economy and expect anything other than chaos.
That's right.
And also alienation from the government. So they've actually, you know, they're quite clever. These are very intelligent people. And they're on the ground, they're beginning to realize the complexity of the situation. But they're still military men, and they're still their primary instruments are military and coercive rather than economic and developmental. And I think somehow that message has got to get from the civil officials and from the more sophisticated military officers to the Oval Office and shift our policy.
Well, maybe the people can have some input on this as well. I think people are getting pretty tired of this war that does seem endless, and we just keep digging and digging and don't seem to be getting anywhere. In fact, we might even lose Karzai to the other side. I know you have to run, Professor McCoy. Thank you very much for being with us. Your new book, most recent book, is Policing America's Empire, the U.S., the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. That's put out by the University of Wisconsin Press. Thank you very much.
And Bert, thank you for an intelligent conversation. I appreciate it.
Well, let's hope we can have an improved future there. Thank you so much.
Sure. Bye now.
Bye. We're going to switch off to a different subject after the break, but it's actually somewhat similar. It's about U.S. responsibility for damage to a country in another war. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Ladies and gentlemen, fellow Americans, lady Americans, this is James Brown. I want to talk to you about one of our most deadly killers in the country today. I had a dream the other night, and I was sitting in my living room. I dozed off to sleep, so I started dreaming. I dreamed I walked in a place, and a I saw a real strange, weird object standing up talking to the people, and I found out it was heroin, that deadly drug that go in your vein. He said, I came to this country without a passport. Ever since then, I've been hunted and sought. My little white grains are nothing but waste, soft and deadly and bitter to taste. But I'm a world of power, and all know it's true. Use me once, and you'll know it too. I can make a mere schoolboy forget his books. I can make a world-famous beauty neglect her looks. I can make a good man forsake his wife, send a greedy man to prison for the rest of his life. I can make a man forsake his country and flag, make a girl sell her body for a $5 bag. Some think my adventure's a joy and a thriller, but I'll put a gun in your hand and make you a killer. In cellophane bags, I found my way to heads of state, to children at play. I finance in China, ran in Japan. I'm respected in Turkey, and I'm legal in Siam. I take my addicts and make them steal, borrow, beg. Then they search for a vein in the arm of the leg.
That's King Heroin, a version by James Brown. He knows whereof he speaks as well. Bert Cohen, still here, and we're going to switch topics just a little bit. Maybe the word Afghanistan is Pashtun for Vietnam. I don't know. Seem to be digging in deeper and deeper and deeper, and there has been certainly a lot of damage done to Afghanistan, as there has been in that earlier quagmire in Vietnam. Our guest now is Merle Ratner. Thanks for being with us, Merle.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you, Bert.
Sure, and she is co-coordinator of the Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign. We all, well, at least people of my age, remember Agent Orange, a chemical defoliant used to clear jungles with the idea that the American soldiers there could see the enemy soldiers. So there's this jungle cover, you wipe out the jungle cover thus protect southern Vietnam from infiltration from the north. That's the theory. One member of a delegation now in Vietnam, Paul Cox, is quoted as saying, Agent Orange is not an artifact of that long ago war. It is a bomb that continues to explode in the lives of the people of Vietnam today. Merle, what does he mean by that?
Well, he means that Agent Orange, which contains dioxin, which is one of probably the most toxic chemical known to science, remains in the bodies and in the genetic material of those exposed to it, and it remains as well in toxic hotspots in Vietnam, such as the toxic hotspot in Da Nang, which is one of the biggest cities in Vietnam. And it continues to poison not only the people that it was sprayed on directly, but it gets into the genetic material, and then it affects their children and grandchildren, and now down to the great-grandchildren. The children are born with horrific birth defects, spina bifida being the least horrific, and neurological defects. And, you know, children are born without eyes, with multiple limbs, without limbs. And the consequences are tragic, both for the health of the people exposed and their children and grandchildren, and for the ecology of Vietnam, which it also really tremendously hurt.
Well, it certainly did. Now, the fighting stopped almost 35 years ago. Actually, it was April 30th, 1975. It finally came to an end, but people are still affected in Vietnam, and not just by the memories of that horrible war. It hasn't been sprayed in all that time. How can it still be affecting the health of humans and the ecosystems? And how long is it toxic? I mean, it's been 35 years since it's been sprayed. How long does the effect of dioxin and the Agent Orange stuff go on?
Well, I don't think anybody knows really how long dioxin can last in the human body and in the soil. Historically, it's a relatively recent thing, having been developed during the World War II time and used during Korea. And thereafter, it's now banned for use either in war or in as a pesticide, but it does. There's more and more information that it does get into the genetic material, into the fatty tissue of the body, mm-hmm. that it affects the reproductive system, and then so the children and grandchildren born to both men and women exposed to Agent Orange are born with much higher rate of birth defects and illnesses. The science on it, you know, really has not gotten beyond that. There is some new work being done to explain exactly how it affects the offspring of those exposed. In terms of the land, in Vietnam, in the hot spots in A Lui and in Da Nang and in Minh Hoa and a few others, it's still in the land. And Hatfield Consultants from Canada, which is a group of experts that studies this, says that the levels are incredibly high even till this day. So there's a need to talk about how do you get it out of the land or contain it. And I should say also that Dow Chemical, one of the top companies along with Monsanto that made and profited from Agent Orange, also has contaminated the land in Midland, Michigan, where its plants are located. And there's also a similar problem of, not at the same level, but a problem that's similar in terms of the Tittawasi River and land around Dow Chemical being contaminated and having to be remediated or fenced off, or there's warning signs there. But nobody knows exactly how long, what the half-life is and exactly how long it will last. But certainly, you know, it's already lasted up to more than three generations.
Wow. I wonder, you know, is there going to be research and development on this to, you know, does any chemical company have any incentive? Is there any kind of subsidy to go in there and dig in the dirt and do some analysis and find out what can be done to neutralize this poison? Do you know if there's anything being done like that?
Well, there is different research, not from the chemical companies, but the chemical companies have had to be dragged kicking and screaming to clean up the land around their plant in Midland. And there's been numerous community coalitions and lawsuits and EPA stuff, and they're just kind of, you know, doing a little bit there. They've done nothing for Vietnam. They've refused to recognize. In fact, Dow Chemical still says that Agent Orange is not deadly. It just causes some minor problems. They're refusing to recognize that. They're refusing to meet their responsibility in any way. There are other groups looking at ways of remediation. There's ways using just containment. There's microorganisms. There's, you know, new biological ways. But they're very expensive. It's not that you can't remediate it at all. It's the fact that there isn't the political will on the part of Dow and Monsanto, and certainly on the part of the U.S. government, there's not enough political will. There's been a small amount, some $6 million over the last couple of years, that's been allocated by Congress, which is certainly a good thing, but it hasn't really been used effectively, either to clean up the land or certainly to compensate the victims. And, you know, the victims really are the poorest people in Vietnam now, because they, you know, they have to take care of these tremendously disabled children. They can't work, so the family gets more and more into poverty. And it's really sad to go into the countryside in Vietnam, because more than 70% of Vietnamese are peasants, to go into the countryside and see a family struggling valiantly to take care of a severely disabled child, and often more than one, you know, and not being able to leave their house to go to work, you know, running out of food, you know, living in really difficult conditions, because there is not sufficient aid. The Vietnamese government and Vietnamese NGOs, like the Vietnam Association for Victims of Agent Orange Dioxin, which represents the Vietnamese Agent Orange victims, does help the victims there. But the money, in, you know, Vietnam is a poor country, and the money's not sufficient. And so it's really up to the U.S. government, who sprayed the chemicals on both the Vietnamese people and on the so-called allied forces, including the Americans, the South Koreans, the Australians, New Zealanders, and the chemical companies who profited at such high rates from making dirty Agent Orange, so Dow, Monsanto, and the other 35. It's really up to them to meet their responsibility to both clean up the land and to pay for comprehensive health care, rehabilitation services, services to families in need, and especially to the children being born every single day with these, you know, really horrible birth defects. And I should say also that the U.S. veterans suffer from the same illnesses, And the U.S. veterans have fought very hard and won a measure of compensation from the Veterans Administration. So there's a list of 15 diseases that are presumed service-connected. So in other words, if you were a veteran and you served in Vietnam at any point and you have one of 15 diseases, including many cancers, you are automatically eligible for veterans' benefits up to 100% disability. You don't have to prove it's connected to Agent Orange. It's presumed, even though the U.S., you know, very hypocritically says there's no proof, but they say that in terms of U.S. veterans, yes, you can get up to 100% disability and free medical care. And it's not enough for U.S. veterans either, and their children are also still not covered for the most part. So we're saying that the U.S. government and the chemical companies need to do the right thing for the Vietnamese people, who were the highest victims and the most victimized and the most affected, but also for the veterans and their children, especially the children who've received nothing, and also for Vietnamese Americans who may have fought on the U.S. side and come here, and then they and their children have been completely forgotten and neglected.
Wow, amazing. We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Merle Ratner, co-coordinator of the Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign. Why don't you tell us about that organization, what you guys are up to? And I believe there is a delegation in Vietnam as we speak.
Yes, it's been quite a busy period for us. We have a veterans delegation, as you mentioned, with Paul Cox and Susan Schnall and Michael Ferner, who's head of Veterans for Peace, and Jeff Millard, who's head of Iraq Veterans Against the War, and a number of other leading veterans who are there doing a study visit to look into the actual conditions on the ground of Agent Orange victims in Vietnam, what their situation is, both in terms of the health of the people and the hotspots. They've actually gone to Da Nang and looked at the hotspot. And they're working with the Vietnam Association for Victims of Agent Orange Dioxin, which represents hundreds of thousands of living and millions of previously living Agent Orange victims, and looking at how we can build more effective assistance and a movement to make sure that the U.S. government and chemical companies actually do what they should be doing and clean up their mess and be responsible to the public health of the victims there and here. And also, we are expecting a delegation of from the Agent Orange Victims Association in the United States starting the middle of April to the middle of May. It will have Pham Thế Minh, who is a young teacher who's himself a second-generation victim of Agent Orange, and we'll have a representative from the Agent Orange Victims Association in Vietnam from Da Nang, and they will be traveling along with U.S. veterans around the U.S. to speak at colleges, at veteran centers, community centers, about the legacy of the war that exists today, and is very much related to the same issues which continue to exist with depleted uranium and other chemical poisoning in Iraq and Afghanistan. And particularly, I want to focus on the Dow Run for Clean Water. Dow Chemical is trying to greenwash itself by pretending to be an environmentally responsible company.
Whoa.
And so they've organized something called the Dow Live Earth Run for Water on April 18th at 8 a.m. in the morning. And there's going to be protests at every Dow Live Earth Run for Water. And we're going to be at the one in Los Angeles, and there's also going to be protests in New York. And here we're working with the people who are asking Dow to clean up its mess in Bhopal, India, from the chemical spill that they inherited, and with people from Midland, Michigan, who are asking Dow to clean up their toxic waste sites in Midland, Michigan. There's going to be runs for clean water in about 20 cities, so I would urge people to look and see if there's a run in your area and show up there at 8 o'clock with signs for Dow Chemicals saying, don't run from your responsibilities. Tell Dow that they have to, you know, they can't say that they stand for clean water while they're continuing to pollute the water in Vietnam and Bhopal and Midland and so many other places. So we're working on that. We're also going to be speaking with people in Congress. We're working on a bill in Congress
that
would say that we as U.S. people, you know, who had our tax dollars used to spray Agent Orange on the Vietnamese people and on all the other soldiers, want our government to do the right thing and be responsible and assist in a massive way, comprehensively assist the Vietnamese people, assist the children and grandchildren of U.S. veterans, and also the Vietnamese Americans exposed to Agent Orange, so that they can live decent lives, they can take care of their families, and that they can maximize the, you know, possible, you know, ways that their health can be improved even after, you know, having this toxic chemical in their body.
Tell us a little bit more about this legislation. Do you know who the sponsors are, and is there a price tag on it? I wonder how, and maybe that's what the delegation is doing now, trying to figure out how much money would be really needed to, you know, seal the land, the dirt that's still, you know, poisoned by Agent Orange. Or I don't know if there's any guess as to how much it might cost to really take care of the problem in Vietnam.
Well, the estimates for the remediation of the land range from $300,000 to $700,000 or more. But the bigger problem, frankly, is the public health consequences. Mm-hmm. Because the hot spots in Vietnam are not the whole country. It's maybe up to 12 hot spots that are fairly contained.
Uh-huh.
And they affect people and people who are living there. But there are Agent Orange victims living outside the hot spots in just about every province of Vietnam. Because while the spraying was in the center and the south, people from the north who came down and fought returned home in large numbers. And so you have hundreds of thousands of people, and increasingly more and more of them are children, who need comprehensive assistance, rehabilitation, health care, education, you know, vocational stuff, all of that. And we think that issue is going to cost even more. We would estimate in somewhere in the millions, I mean the billions. We said between, you know, a very rough estimate is between $3 and $15 billion to comprehensively assist these families so that they can live with dignity and not be so poor that they can't eat, which is what many of them are suffering now. The legislation, we're working with a number of congresspersons, and we'll announce that when the legislation is ready to roll out.
Uh-huh.
We do expect that we'll have pretty good support from a number of committees in Congress. We found that a lot of the constituents, particularly the U.S. veterans, feel passionate about this issue. That, you know, they know what happened in Vietnam because they were there. They were the ones that were given this Agent Orange to spray and told it wasn't dangerous and they could even drink it. And they were the ones that were forced to be exposed to it while they were exposing the Vietnamese people. So we're finding that not only our veterans delegation in Vietnam, but veterans all over the U.S., along with Vietnamese Americans, along with peace and justice activists, environmental activists, you know, many, many parts of our community feel strongly that this is something that's long overdue, that justice delayed is justice denied, and that now is the time to finally, you know, end what's called the last ghost of war, the most horrific consequences of the Vietnam War. And also, this needs to remind us that we have to stop using chemical warfare,
mm-hmm.
whether it be in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Colombia, in Vieques, or anywhere else. So that's the other part of our campaign, is that we want this to serve as a warning that if our government uses chemical warfare now and in the future, that there will be responsibility. They can't just say, okay, we're going to walk away now that we've done this. And I know that one of our members of our veterans delegation is suffering from depleted uranium, is
mm-hmm.
quite ill from it.
Yeah,
and so we see the consequences of this kind of warfare being repeated, you know,
again,
in the wars today. So it's very much connected.
And I can imagine hearing from veterans in particular that, you know, they have obviously earned their credibility, and I would think that would make a big difference on members of Congress. So we'll stay on top of that. Where is President Obama on this? Have you heard anything from the relatively new administration on U.S. responsibility and trying to do something about it?
I think that, frankly, he has not had a chance to develop a policy on this.
Mm-hmm.
My sense is that he's been pretty much, you know, had his plate full with
health care. For sure.
And, which is a good thing, and
oh,
then
yeah.
the war, which is certainly not a good thing. But
right.
My sense is he probably hasn't been able to focus on this, and it's our job to kind of put this in front of him and his administration in a way that he can understand, you know, the responsibility and why this is a good thing for U.S.-Vietnam relations and for particularly for people-to-people relations. So that's really our job, and my guess is that he hasn't really focused on relations with Vietnam in general, and this is a key issue in the relations in particular. But my sense is that now that health care, such that it is,
yes.
has been enacted, the administration will have more chance to focus on other issues, as will the Congress.
Yeah.
Because it's also true that some of our folks in Congress who were working on this kind of said, well, you know, this will have to happen after health care
right.
because we're subsumed by that. And now we expect, you know, that this is going to be one of the things that people can focus on.
And one thing that we have now is the U.S. has very good relations, I believe, with the government of Vietnam, a unified Vietnam, which certainly could have happened a heck of a lot earlier than it did, but that's another story. What is the government of Vietnam doing? Do they have... they're doing business with lots of people in the world. We seem to be buying a lot of things from that are made in Vietnam. Do they have capability to address this? And what are they doing on this?
Yeah, the government of Vietnam actually has been pretty proactive, particularly after the Vietnam Association for Victims of Agent Orange Dioxin, the group that represents the victims, formed. And they've been working with the Vietnamese government to make people aware of this issue and doing public education in Vietnam and organizing and advocacy in Vietnam as well as internationally. And the Vietnamese government has responded to the grassroots movement in Vietnam very, very well. They have a program to give monetary assistance to the hardest off families, for example, that have, you know, one parent and several children who are really, really poor. The government gives them, like, some kind of Social Security monthly stipend, and then there's free medical care for others that are not quite as badly off, or free scholarships to school, et cetera. And also, as I said, the Agent Orange Victims Association has its own fund that they also give assistance to the victims in addition to what the government gives. However, Vietnam, despite its, you know, really incredible development and gains in poverty alleviation, is still a very poor country. It's a big country, more than 80 million people.
Wow.
And so they don't have the wherewithal to give sufficient assistance to the Agent Orange families. What they give is what they can afford, and they are trying to fund, you know, some of the projects with the Agent Orange Victims Association. But, you know, it's not nearly sufficient, and it really needs those responsible to pitch in and give, you know, massive assistance to the victims. I should say the victims, you know, are very are organized. The Agent Orange Victims Association in Vietnam is organized to the provincial level, the district level, and in many communes. And it's actually a grassroots organization where they work with the victims who are not neurologically impaired or, you know, in the leadership in many cases. And they work very much in the community. They go door to door. They build projects. They do educational work in the society as a whole. So it's quite an impressive organization on its own. And I think the government has done quite a good job responding to it. And recently, the party in Vietnam, which is quite powerful, adopted a resolution saying that this was a primary issue, a very key issue for the country. And so there's been even more resources being directed from the government, from NGOs, and even to some extent from Vietnamese businesses donating to the work of the Agent Orange Victims Association. So
Merle,
I think the response there is they're doing as well as they can do, but it's really our responsibility to, you know, to meet what we need to do.
Merle, we just have a few minutes left. What can people do? What would justice look like with regard to this? And certainly Congress, any member of Congress can initiate activity on this, and it wouldn't really cost that much in relation to how much we put into destroying Vietnam. What can people do? And I'm sure people might be interested. Well, again, we should touch on the Dow Chemical nonsense that's going on, this greenwash, as you say. Make sure people know about that. How could people find out more about all this Agent Orange stuff?
Okay, they can. Our website of our campaign is www.vn, like Vietnam, -agentorange.org. www.vn-agentorange, all one word, .org. Where they can email info@vn-agentorange.org. And we'll plug them into some of the protests at the Dow Run for Clean Water. We can get them involved in our speaking tour or other activities. And, of course, you know, they can donate money if they'd like, which is always very much appreciated. But we're building a movement, so we'd like, you know, people across the country, since I know you have a radio audience across the country, we'd like people to get involved. We're building local cores of people to take up this issue in many cities across the country. Ah. There'll be opportunities to host delegations like the one we're bringing. There'll be opportunities to travel to Vietnam to look at the situation and meet the victims there. So it's quite a dynamic movement. It's historical, but it's very, very much contemporary, and it's very much linked to the struggles against the war here and against the use of chemical weapons. So it's actually quite a dynamic movement, and we actually expect to win compensation for the people in Vietnam, for the kids of veterans here, and for Vietnamese Americans. So we think it's a struggle that we're building enough power, and we're building enough
momentum,
grassroots pressure. And so it's a chance to be part of something that's really going to make a difference in people's lives.
Wow. There's not much you can do in life that you know you're really making a difference in people's lives. Thank you. Merle Ratner, co-coordinator of the Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign. Thanks very much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show. And best
thank
of luck
you,
with
Bert,
everything.
Thank you, Bert. I'm very happy to be here.
All right. Thank you very much. And happy to hear your input. Email me, Bert, B-U-R-T, at theburtcohenshow.com. Always happy to hear your comments and suggestions on that. Thanks very much for listening. And we'll go back a little bit in history to, kind of a protest song about Vietnam.
Give me an
chances come at last. Gotta go out, get those reds. The only good commie is one that's dead. And you know that peace could only be won when the golden rule of kingdom come.
And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates. Throughout the land, pack your
your boys off to Vietnam. Come on, fathers, don't hesitate. Send them off before it's too late. Be the first one on your block to have your boy come home in a box.